We're sponsored by Requeered Tales, preserving our LGBTQ literary heritage one book at a time. Check them out at requeeredtales.com. Coming up, John Copenhaver, the busiest man in promoting queer crime fiction, talks about his upcoming novel, which is already receiving high praise. But first, Justine recommends a novel that would impress Nostradamus. Will it make you laugh? Will it make you cringe? Or maybe both? I'm Brad Shreve, and you're listening to Queer Writers of Crime, featuring LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Justine, I am so happy to have you back. I missed you.
I miss being here.
Greg was fun, but he wasn't you.
Well, I don't know. Greg's pretty special.
You know, I have not brought up Paul Rudd in quite some time.
Oh, you didn't bring him up any time I was gone? Oh,
no.
God.
I haven't brought him up at all. And I can bring him up now because this is going to fall under the category of a thriller.
Okay.
I don't know if you know, in November, Ghostbusters 3 comes out. And stars Paul Rudd.
Oh, I didn't realize he was starring in that.
Yes.
I know that Ghostbusters 3 is coming out.
Yeah, the whole Ghostbusters reboot with Melissa McCarthy, who is grossly overrated. They're acting as if that movie never existed.
Yes, I've heard that.
This is going to be a sequel to the original movies years later.
Yes, I knew that. I just did not know it starred Paul Rudd.
It does star Paul Rudd, so I don't care whether it's a good movie or not. It's 2 hours of Paul Rudd. That's all that matters. So November 11th
okay.
is the release date. Keep it in mind.
Excellent. I will.
I have so very little to talk about today because I'm just giddy that you're back. I'm going to let you just go for it. I should mention John Copenhaver is our guest today. He is probably the busiest man in literature as far as LGBTQ literature, especially crime fiction, doing all kinds of things. But that's pretty much it. Other than that, I'm ready to hear what you're talking about.
All right. Well, I am talking about The Chicken Asylum by Fred Hunter. It is the fifth book and the final book in the Alex Reynolds mystery series. And you'll be very happy to hear that you don't have to have read the series at all. It works very well as a standalone. It doesn't even have very many spoilers. Actually, no spoilers for the previous books.
I love that.
The characters are developing. So, it's continuous. It's not one of those, mystery of the week where everybody is just kind of the same. But there's no reason to read the earlier books. It was published on October 5th, 2001, but it was written before that. And it's surprising how you would think it was written with 9/11 in mind. Alex Reynolds is a young man who had a graphic design business, but now works part-time for the CIA. And his husband, Peter, has kept his day job at a men's clothing store, and they live with his mother, who is very accepting, and she's very English. She immigrated to America 35 years before, still has her English accent, comes off with all sorts of wild and crazy fans. So the whole thing is a zany caper, but the CIA comes to them and says, "We would like you to house this Iraqi soldier who is defecting from Iraq, and we're bringing him over here. We're giving him a new identity in exchange for him telling us where Saddam Hussein's chemical weapons are." So the soldier comes over. They expect this big, burly, hirsute man, and he looks like a kid. And they realize in short order that he's gay, which is, they suspect, why their CIA contact, Lawrence Nelson, has put him there. The CIA guys all come over every day from 9 to 5 to interrogate him about, bring out maps and where is it. And it's all in Arabic, so they can't hear any, they don't understand anything that's going on. They take him out at night to the local gay club where his eyes are as big as saucers. And he goes in the back to and go to the bathroom, and they wander up with him making a call in which he's speaking Arabic. And then the whole thing comes off from there. I don't want to get too spoilery about this now, but I can't remember how much we knew before 9/11 and how much of this was just his particular interest in the subject. Certainly there had been the first World Trade Center bombing. There had been the Oklahoma City bombing. There was all that dispute over Saddam Hussein's chemical weapons and the UN inspectors going in. So that may well have given him enough fodder to have put together this plot, which in hindsight is very, very accurate. They're in Chicago, but you would think he was just doing a cheap ripoff of 9/11. However, there's a lot of humor in the book. It's a caper where if it wasn't so close to the 9/11 story, man, it would be pure fun. You know, they get in trouble with all sorts of bad guys, but it does take on a little bit of somber overtones. I think it works. I think we're far enough away now. I don't know how it did in that first year, but I think we're far enough away that the whole thing seems, it doesn't have the kind of result that happened on 9/11. It just it captures the pre-times very well.
And you got to realize for old farts like us, there are kids in college that have no recollection of 9/11 whatsoever.
That's true. That's true. And all the books that are centered around there are very serious. And if you're personally affected, this will probably offend you. But I think it's a lot of fun. It's a great book. It was the last in the series, so I'm not sure that it did well enough for him to have continued the series. But I think the readers will enjoy it. I think despite the heavy overtones, it's a delightful book.
You giving a delightful recommendation?
I am.
Now, would you call this a suspense, a thriller?
It's a bit of a thriller. It's a bit of a thriller, but it's also a bit of a mystery.
Okay.
Because you never know exactly who is who. It's not the kind of thing where it's very suspenseful, but you don't know if this guy is a killer. You don't know where the defected Iraqi soldier fits into the whole thing. You don't know whether the minor characters floating in are, FBI agents, CIA agents, random people trying to pick up the Iraqi soldier because he's fresh and new. Or if he's, it's an undercover terrorist or just some old friend. So there's a lot of that mystery sort of whodunit appeal.
So there's mystery, there's a thriller, it's a terrorist and zany.
Yeah.
As Spock would say, that's fascinating.
That is fascinating. And I got to say, unless that kind of stuff is a trigger for you, I think there's something for everything in this book.
Yeah, it sounds like it would be unfair for somebody to be offended by it since it was written before 9/11, but I can see why it may make them feel uncomfortable.
Yes. No, that's definitely true. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it sounds fun. I love the Chicken Asylum. I want to just know what that's about.
I don't know.
The title.
I read the book and I was like, I still don't know what it is.
You don't know how the title applies to the book?
Nope. I'm sure somebody who's read it will tell me.
Yes.
Yeah, somebody who's read it needs to tell me because I'm not sure I caught that.
Yeah, let us know. And then Justine will let you know the next time she's on.
Sounds good to me.
Okay. And do you have anything from Recruit Tales today?
Well, the next Lev Raphael book is coming out and it's on pre-order. It has a foreword by Meg Perry, who's written the Jamie Brody mysteries. Jamie Brody as a librarian. And Nick Hoffman is an English professor, so she was really just right to do the foreword for this book. It is on pre-order. It'll be out on August 24th.
Well, I have three things to say about that.
Okay.
I love Meg Perry. Lev Raphael is always one of my favorite guests. We always have a good time when he's on. And I love his Nick Hoffman series.
That's so great.
And I always say I like his Nick Kaufman series because I really care about Nick and his life.
All right. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye. Interact with other crime fiction fans and authors in our Game Mystery Thriller Suspense Fiction group on Facebook. Links are on our website, queerwritersofcrime.com. John Copenhaver, if people are not familiar with your books, they certainly are familiar with you if they read at all, because your name is everywhere. Sisters of Crime, it seems whatever event is going on, you are there. Considering you do that and teach and promoting your books, how do you find the time?
Oh, well, I don't know. I mean, I think that I just started saying yes to a lot of things. I think it really comes out of a desire to participate and you know, bolster other voices in the community. And just, I think I always admire these writers who do a lot, you know, not just to promote themselves, not just to get involved with selling their books, but they're also about building the community. Because, you know, one thing that I learned, especially through my MFA days and going through all that, is that a writing community is so important to have. And so, you know, a writing community has supported me in a lot of ways. So I just kind of want to be there and support them in as many ways as I can. So the secret to some of it, though, just to be honest, is that last year I wasn't teaching. So
okay.
I had a lot more time to I judged Best Paperback Original for the Edgars. I did the judging for Sisters in Crime. I helped organize some other things as well. And that was largely because I had that time. And it was a bit by design. I was like, here's the sort of time I'm going to spend writing. I'm going to spend working on that part of my life. And that's what I did. And now I'm going back to the classroom. So to a new school yeah. And to a whole new situation. That time will get much thinner and fewer opportunities to do that stuff. But I hope, you know, once again in the future to return to some of it.
And I do want to talk about the community building that you mentioned. I want to get to that a little later. But first, sure. I want to tell you something about The Savage Kind. I had Meredith Dench on and Robin Geigel on, and I told both of them, I never used to read prologues. I'm one of those people, I know writers hate it. I'm one of those people that never read prologues. I just skipped right to chapter one. And in both of their cases, I was glad I read the prologue. And I got to say, they cured me of this illness. And I loved yours.
Oh, thanks.
And what I found fascinating about was it told me everything and absolutely nothing about your story. It was genius. So, because I felt, I'm like, wow, I'm really getting it. You really just set the tone, if nothing else.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the power of prologues they are incredibly strong tone setting devices. And they can do a lot to sort of tease, you know, a story for the reader. In other words, like throw a lot of questions out there, essentially. And I think any reader that has a lot of questions in those first few pages, that's going to make them want to read more. So I particularly like that. But also, I think you're 100% right. I think tone is key. I know a lot of people, you're not the only one. There's a lot of people that say, the other thing that they say is like, you know, I skip over anything that's italicized. I was like, don't skip over it because it's italicized. Italicized is actually for emphasis.
I've never heard that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the other thing I heard. I think it's actually a reader. I think I heard this in a workshop at some point. And I was like, well, I don't know. I mean, I can't help what readers are going to do or not do. That's kind of the reader's journey with the text, I guess. But I think you would be missing something to skip prologues. You know, occasionally there's a prologue which feels like just a scene someone pulled out from some later point in the book and threw at the front just to capture the reader's attention. And I think it may be effective, but it actually that annoys me a little bit. Because I'm not a reader that needs the blood spattered on the first page or whatever to get me going. I need voice. I need character. I need that richness. That's just me as a reader. I know some people like, you know, the body of the first page, and that's fine too. But it's just interesting. In other words, I guess what I'm saying is prologues can be lots of different things.
Yeah. Yeah. I think my perception is, and I know this is actually true of some authors, is it's all backstory that I feel like should have been written into the novel to begin with. So yeah. Having experienced that, I kind of had this perception that that was always the case. And yeah. of the yeah. three of you that I mentioned, that was not true at all. So lesson learned.
Yeah. I think it's just the difference between an effective prologue and an ineffective prologue.
As with all writing.
Right.
Well, let's tell people who you are. John Copenhaver's historical crime novel, Dodging and Burning, won the 2019 McCavity Award for Best First Mystery Novel and garnered Anthony Strand Critics, Barry and Lambda Literary Award nominations. His second novel, The Savage Kind, arrives in October 2021. Copenhaver writes a crime fiction review column for Lambda Literary called Blacklight, co-host on the House of Mystery radio show, and is a six-time recipient of Artist Fellowship from the D.C. Commission on the Arts and Humanities. He's a Larry Neal awardee, and his work has appeared in Crime Reads, Electric Lit, Glitter Wolf, Pank, New York Journal of Books, Washington Independent Review of Books, and others. He has taught high school English for nearly 20 years. He grew up in the mountains of southwestern Virginia and currently lives in Richmond, Virginia, with his husband, artist Jeffrey Paul Herity. So again, welcome, John.
Thank you so much for having me on, Brad. I love this podcast. So this is super exciting to be able to chat with you about mystery writing.
Well, there's one thing I'm gonna get out of the way first of all. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to ask why you chose to have lesbians as your protagonist in the novel, because I think mm-hmm. you're gonna have that question a lot, and I don't care. My question, though, similar to that, is given that you had prominent lesbians in Dodging and Burning, and especially in this novel, have you experienced or do you expect any kind of backlash as a result of that?
I hope not. I mean, I think that in Dodging and Burning, it was really more focused on this, straight female characters. There are some prominent lesbian characters in there, but they weren't, the real sort of focus of the book. Whereas in Savage Kind, we have these two young women in 1948 who are falling for each other in complex ways, enamored with their English teacher, and then, getting wrapped up in solving a crime and perhaps committing a few. And it's simply like a story that, I felt really compelled to tell. It's not particularly, I don't think anyone, speaking from any perspective, is trying to sort of own and sort of say, this is the way it was for a particular group of people. I don't even want to say that for gay men, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the way it is for John Copenhaver, but it's not the way it is for all gay men. And I think that's true. And I also think that, if you're writing complex, authentic characters with lots of dimensions, with lots of sort of big moral, emotional, even maybe spiritual questions going on inside of them, then, you're doing your work as a writer. And so, I hope that ultimately what I hope is that anyone that sort of wonders about that idea will read it and sort of see, how I deal with the characters. I have a lot of love for them, and I've done a lot of research and thoughtful research, and talking to, my lesbian friends, but truly the research that I felt, because it's a historical text and I set in 1948, was to do the research and think about the time period. I hope that people will be open to this idea. By the way, I'm fine with people writing gay characters. Gay male characters or whatever. I just want them to be complex and rich and thought provoking. So it's more about it's more about the quality than anything,
Exactly. And talking about engaged characters, I want to go straight to the book now then. Mm-hmm. The Savage Kind, I found it disturbing and yet engaging at the same time. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the characters. Let's start with, is it Philippa?
Philippa.
Mm-hmm. I've been getting mm-hmm. it right. Watson. She's kind of troubled, angry, and I was mm-hmm. absolutely fascinated by her. So let's start with her.
Yeah. So Philippa is very much, at least on the all outward appearances, the sort of good girl. You know, she definitely dresses in the mode of the time period. She wears that veneer, but she's got a lot of anger in her. A lot of this anger comes from not having a mother, not growing up with a mother. Her mother died in childbirth. So that adds a lot of complexity to her. She's also a teenager. and I teach them a lot. And so I understand to some degree what is going on inside their heads. It's kind of my job. And so I think that there's that sort of anger too. And so I really wanted to portray what I might come across as an average kid, but I don't certainly think that, hope she doesn't come across as average on the page, but she's within the realm of kind of a normal range of emotions for high school kid of that era in that time period. She's also beginning to deal with her sexuality. And I mean, this is a time period when there's not a lot of sort of, there's certainly no social signifiers that she could find. And there's nothing she could look to for an example. And the only kind of information she has about, you know, her sexuality, it's all sort of negative. It's all newspapers reporting on it or general sort of social conversation about it. And it usually falls into category of either being, you know, a mental illness or in some ways morally dubious. And so I think that she, you know, she certainly, that's all she has. So what does she do? You know, and how does she start discovering herself in this environment that is not rich with what we have today? Today we still have a lot of work to do, but it's like, there's at least, you can find these characters, right? You can go on Netflix or go to your library and bookstore and find these characters. And that was not an option in her time period, really. So
given that era of the mm-hmm. viewpoint towards queer, gay, lesbians, transgender folks, is that what compels you? The first novel was in the 1940s, Dodging and Burning. This right. one's in the 1950s. Is that what part of what compels you to write during that era, or what is it that?
So it's interesting. Yes. So the short answer is yes. I think it's such an interesting time period. There's a lot of social upheaval going on at the time. There's the sort of movement from wartime to then what will come one of the most conservative and actually least pleasant times to be a gay person in our country mm-hmm. in the 20th century, which is the 1950s. It's a fascinating change. I'm also really fascinated by what women went through in general during that time period. And I get this because my mom is exactly the age of the characters in both of my books. So, you know, I've understood a little bit about her attitudes and how she's evolved. And she's a very strong, very, you know, very reflective woman. But she's also, and I think that time period was very hard for her because a lot of her aspirations and things that I think she probably would have done with her life, she was told by the men in her life that she couldn't do. And so I think that I'm fascinated with like two young women in the case of The Savage Kind, but also Dodging and Burning has similar characters in it as well, that really want to be something else than what the world is telling them. And in many ways, not just being straight versus lesbian, or actually Judy's bi, but the same, she's still figuring that out. But you know, I think that they're, you know, moving into this place. That's one issue, but just about women, like their roles, the possibilities and their roles during the 1950s were so limited. But I also wanted to make them like really sharp. To be interesting, I want them to push against all those sort of ideas about who they should be during that time period. It creates, you know, the 1950s, and this is book, Savage Kind is book one of three books, and I'm going to take them through the 1950s to the early 60s to kind of play out that journey for them. So I'm excited to see how it evolves after The Savage Kind.
Well, you mentioned Judy's name. If you could tell us a little bit about Judy, and also what attracts the two of them to each other.
Sure. So Judy is it presents very differently than Philippa. Judy is for the time period, very rebellious in the way she looks, the way she carries herself, her demeanor. She's got like these very severe black bob, like circa 1920s. So clearly out of the time framework. She wears like loose outfits and she has dark eye makeup. I mean, she's kind of, you know, my idea of what a goth person might be during that time period. And she is not, I mean, she is makes it clear that people need to stay away from her. And of course, all the kids at school don't like her because she's such, you know, she's really doing that. And I think what Philippa sees in her is someone who I think she more identifies with, even though she doesn't present that way. Someone she says, like, this person I think may have something that I recognize in myself. And it's a kind of a darkness. And that's the look, you know, the book goes and it goes through those complexities of the darknesses that both, you know, these young women have inside of them. But I think that it's more externalized and honest, a little more honest with Judy up front. And I have great affection for Judy because she's just, you know, she says it like it is. She's not always very nice, but.
Well, that's why I liked her too. And it, right off the start, as you said in the very beginning, it seemed like it was that darkness that mm-hmm. brought that attraction to each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
Most definitely.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that is. I think they are attracted to each other's darkness in really complex ways. I think in some really healthy ways and some really unhealthy ways they are. I think to find more sort of that a person who has is suffering or struggling in a more open and honest way, you know, pulls them together. I think they find solace in each other. The problem is they have a lot going on in their lives. Judy has a particularly complex backstory. She was adopted by this wealthy family, and they kind of wanted to use her as a fill-in or a stand-in for their daughter who had been murdered. And so she has trying to figure out who she is in that framework as well. And it has done a number on her because she hardly remembers who she was. And so as much as the story about figuring out kind of what's going on with her teacher and this classmate that winds up dead, it's also a journey for them, both young women coming to some understanding of who they are. And it's a theme that I'll continue through the series, you know, if I'm lucky enough to be able to, you know, write and publish them all.
Whenever I have somebody that writes something historical, I always ask the question, what did you find the most fascinating thing in your research? I'm going to be a little more specific with you. Mm-hmm. What did you find in your research the most interesting when it came to attitudes during that era?
I think the thing that continues to surprise me is just how I think ultimately this was being gay, lesbian, certainly trans. It was just not talked about. And when it was, I mean, it wasn't just like we're going to talk about it. It was just really almost it was almost a non-possibility, you know? Mm-hmm. There's no language for it. I think that we have a language today, you know, because all of us are living post-Stonewall, you know, even when it's tough and when there's a language, a common language. It just wasn't that was available, especially to young people at the time period. You know, eventually people, they would go to cities and find their people, right? And I thought, and then you sort of have a code or a language, but when you're young, you don't have any of that. And I think that's particularly painful. And I think that's true of this time period. So I think even more so, the more oppressive, socially oppressive the time period, the more conservative the time period, the less that language is available to sort of the broad population. And so I think that's the thing. I'm not sure if surprise is the right word, but I think it's still in some ways kind of constantly, it's so creepy to me. I guess it kind of surprises me in that sort of lurking way. This is a really creepy thing that society did to us. There's all the violence we talk about but this sort of like erasure, I guess, is the thing that I find really disturbing. Oh, well, it's all disturbing, but it's this thing that continues to sort of creep in and bother me. So I think that may be it, really.
You grew up in the South and I grew up in the South. We both came around 35 years old. You lived in more of a rural environment than I did, but do you think that whole attitude that still somewhat exists in the South and especially in rural areas, do you think that was part of the process of why it took so long for you to come out?
Yeah, well, certainly speaking from my point of view, it was, I mean, it was a combination of things, but growing up in a small town where it was definitely a problem to be gay and generally thought of by certainly my parents as something defective. And the big sort of theme in my household that plagued me is that my father died when I was 8. And so there's this very problematic idea. And I think it still persists to a certain degree, but certainly was inflicted upon me. And I'll say, I don't think I you know, I've dealt with my mom and all this stuff, so it's all fine now. But I think that it's true is this idea that, oh, well, he didn't have a strong male figure in his life. So that's why some things are going awry. And then I was sent to boarding school because that would be the solution for the strong male figure. And it wasn't. It was probably the most homophobic place I existed or lived. And I have a lot of positive memories of the place, but it was a big problem. This, you know, the homophobia, and I pushed my sexuality deep. I was almost in the closet to myself. I mean, I almost couldn't admit it to myself. Mm-hmm. And I remember I had a good friend at Woodbury who was feminine, and he just couldn't pass, and he was in a lot of ways tortured because of it. He was incredibly strong and still one of my heroes because he just put up with it and figured it out. And so I marvel at that bravery, but it was also terrifying to see from my standpoint. So I think that sent me back an even longer. And I think it is something, you know, that happens this, and I think it still happens. I had one interesting exchange with a writer friend, and she was like, she's like, it's hard for me to believe that gay men are still in the closet, especially in the city or any, you know. It's like, listen, it's complex. And I think if you grew up with that mentality, even if you moved to a city, and by the way, when I came out, I was living in DC. So it took moving to a city to actually get to that point. And I said, it's about the mentality. It's like the closet is a place that you sort of have created in your mind, and you have to tear down those walls. And unfortunately, you're the only person, you have to do the work. No one's going to do it for you, certainly. And that's exhausting, of course, and it shouldn't be that way, but that's the truth. So yeah, I mean, it certainly, I think it has a lot to do with where you grew up and your point of view. And I think there are people that never fully tear down the walls, and they may live in their hometowns, or they may go to the city and still have those walls up. So this idea about the closet being a place of the past is, I don't think it's true. But hopefully less so than before.
What I found is I'm going to be coming out my entire life. It's not a one-time deal. Every time I get a new job, or every time I meet somebody new, if I start a new job, I don't just walk in the door and say, I'm gay. You know, just doesn't work that way. So it's kind of this gradual thing. And there's usually somebody that's not real cool with it, even though they may keep their mouth shut. But it's just kind of in casual conversation. I'll mention my husband Maurice here and there. And then people get that clue. But when you first walk in the door, for me, it's a little uncomfortable. Still, I wish it wasn't, but not everybody in Los Angeles is progressive, no matter how it may appear to the rest of the world.
Right. Exactly. This idea that that's the case is not true. And, you know, equally that's connected to that idea is people being... Now, you were asked me earlier about what I was surprised about. What people often tell me they were surprised about in Dodging and Burning is how bad it was. Mm-hmm. That being gay was really, I mean, they're surprised that our current day sensibilities were not true back in 1940. And they usually say, you know, not they're not resisting it. They're just like, I didn't know. And so I think that is one of those things that's why sometimes it's important to remember where all this starts and that you know, like you said, it's not over. You're right. We're always coming out because we're going to do that because the dominant culture still just defaults to straight, you know, they default to it. And you're always being like, so how's your wife? Well, my husband.
We get that all the time.
My husband as well.
We get that all the time. Yes.
Jeff and I went, on our trip recently, we walked into like a fast food joint, and this lady behind the counter is being very nice. And she was like, so are you guys brothers? It's like, no, we're husbands. She's like, oh, that's great. But it's funny, the default for her was, we must be brothers.
Similar along those lines, Maurice and I were considering moving to Omaha to be closer to my daughter at one point. And there was a house for rent, and we called. This was before we got married. And we called to check on the rent and ask about the house. And the woman said, well, who would be living there? And I said, my partner and I. And she goes, oh, you can't run a business out of my house.
Yep. Not that kind of partner.
Well, it's exactly the reason I don't really like that term. But it seems to be getting more and more used. Yeah.
Yeah, but I started using life partner, but that sounds a little like, you know, but I don't know. Well, I mean, we're married now, so say husband, but before I was sort of like, just to make it clear, you know, my partner in life, well, Jeff, or whatever.
It seems like it was always my partner or my lover. And
yeah, I can't use the lover.
Neither work. It just doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
Well, let's get back to the book.
Sure.
We talked about Philippa and Judy. Give us the plot. What's the story about?
Yeah. So, you know, it's a mystery novel, of course. And we talked about Judy and Philippa a bit and how they meet. But the storyline, it centers around their mutual affection for their high school teacher, who is a sort of Miss Jean Brody type, if you get that reference. She's kind of glamorous. She loves poetry. She recites poetry beautifully, and she just has a real mystique around her. They also see her as a model. Like I mentioned before, they're looking for a model, and she's more modern. Her sensibilities are more modern, that kind of thing. And Philippa, at one point, borrows a mystery novel for her. And this is a little scandalous for Philippa, because she thinks that mysteries are subpar, like they're not high literature, right? So she's, you know, because she's trying to put on airs being a young person, she's only reading sophisticated literature. But Miss Martin says, no, you'll really love this. So she reads it. She loves it. She goes to return it. She finds her teacher is being attacked, and she's not sure what she's seen, but she thinks she might have seen her teacher being raped or assaulted. But once again, that goes back to that sort of, they don't have fully the language for all that at that point. It's seen very differently. And so she's confused about what she's seen. Judy, being more world savvy, just doesn't know exactly what Philippa's seen, but questions it. Then a few days later, this student that they've been in class with, who has been very antagonistic towards Miss Martin's, this boy, winds up dead. He's been murdered. And in a way that's very similar to the way that I mentioned Judy replaced the daughter of her adoptive family, very similar murder. And so these two things happen, and they don't seem related, but guess what, folks? It's a mystery novel. They probably are. And so the mystery kind of takes off from that point. And one of the things that I played with a lot in the novel was both that Judy and Philippa investigate the crime, but they also begin to sort of move into complex moral territory themselves as the crime gets closer and closer to their own lives, and maybe even step over that boundary a little bit. I described the book initially to people as sort of my homage to the femme fatale character, kind of the coming of age story that I kind of always hoped that she would have. I have particular affection for the femme fatale figure, but I always wanted to write a slightly different story for her. I've always seen her as glamorous, powerful, but always, you know, particularly in this traditional mode of femme fatale from the great films in the 1940s, the detective fiction, she's always punished, often by death in the ends of these. And I always wanted her to have a different ending, because I think that in a lot of ways she symbolizes female power, and she's being quashed because the moment is about the patriarchy, particularly in the 1940s and early and 50s. So I had a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun playing around with all those motifs.
It is very complex, and there's something I really loved about it. Remind me of Lev Raphael's Nick Hoffman stories. And why I say that is his novels, if you took the mystery out, I would still really enjoy them because the characters are interesting, the story is interesting, their lives are interesting. And that's what I found with this novel. It took out the mystery, you'd have a, still have a great book.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you.
You're very welcome. Fortunately, as a mystery lover, you know, it's the best of both worlds. So good job for you.
Well, you know, I love both too. I'm not an either or guy, which is even why you have some of this dialogue in the book about the high literature versus, you know, and I'm doing air quotes right now, low literature of mystery fiction. And I don't believe in those distinctions. And I think that it can be really fun to blend them. And I think there's a dialogue, and I kind of chafe at putting them in these sort of separate places, because there are some literary writers, and once again, air quotes, that steal from the genre. And there's some wonderful mysteries that are just as rich as any literary novel you'll come across. So I think that, you know, I certainly like to play around with those two things. So I guess it's kind of a mashup coming of age mystery story.
You're going to take me, just from what you said, it's going to sound like a negative route I'm going in. And that's not... In the end, I hope that's not the way it come across. But the first question I want to ask you is, your novels are not promoted as LGBTQ novels. They're just promoted as mysteries, thrillers, whatever. Right. I presume that's on purpose. And why?
I think the on purpose is because I think that ultimately the readership, it expands the readership. And it's not, it's certainly, I want LGBTQ readers first and foremost, but I think I'd also love a lot of straight readers. My wish, I think ultimately, is that we don't have to pitch things just to one audience or the other. My wish, if I could send it out to the universe, the publishing universe, is that the LGBTQ stories are for everyone. And that's true for any marginalized group. You know, We don't have to read just in our lane. And I teach young people, and they don't read in their lane. And by that mean, just read like their mirror fiction that just mirrors their lives. Like, since I'm a white straight person, I'm only going to read white straight people. I don't think young people are certainly not trained by their teachers to do that. And I think there's a growing sensibility that that's not true anymore. But I feel like publishing still really wants to, the feedback you always get is like, you know, people only read in their lane. So if you're right, if you're only marketing to, or your book is sort of sold as like a queer book, then less people are going to read it. And I think that was true for Dodging and Burning. Because that was 2018 or whatever that was, you know, a century ago, it feels like it's so I want to report it is changing a little bit. I know that with some of the marketing around The Savage Kind, and this is more from my publisher's point of view, they've deliberately wanted to sort of step out and make sure that people understand that it is a queer book, an LGBTQ book, which gives me some hope that we will, you know, get over this idea of sort of staying in our lane. The publishers will get over sort of marketing in your lane, because I think readers are smarter, more intuitive, and more open than we're giving them credit for, frankly. So I hope things change.
I hope so too. A friend of mine wrote a novel that's kind of a swashbuckling adventure novel that happens to have gay characters, and great reviews, but it came up several times. Why did he have to have those characters be gay? I didn't know that's what I was getting into. Well, because you know what? Back then they had gay people too.
Yeah. And why is that? I don't know. I mean, frankly, there are going to be those people out there.
Yeah, they'll always exist.
Yeah. And I know sometimes their feedback seems to loom large. There are a lot of people who are just like, oh, okay, cool. You know, I think they're fine with it. And I think we have to give the people who may be more the silent but more positive folks a little more credit than the folks that are just going to complain and make remarks like that. And I think, you know, I don't know what to do about that reader. They're reading in their lane. They've decided that they're upset that they felt like you gave them a book that was out of their lane. They want something that just reflects their own attitudes and point of view. They don't want to step outside of that. And I think my feeling is that most readers who want to read more expansively are going to be okay with trying on and exploring new characters. And then one thing that I keep on pointing out, and I think it's good for the genre. So I think, and I don't, you know, I preach to the choir here a little bit to you, but I think that having gay characters and gay primary characters gives the story different directions it can go. It gives the more possibilities for different kinds of plots and different kinds of stories that I think people, you know, they're consuming a lot of mystery fiction these days. They want to see something new occasionally come across their path. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know. I'm not sort of saying that there aren't a lot of hurdles and that it isn't serious and that publishing is so slow to change. It is all those things. I am happy to have a publisher that will walk that sort of line with me and trying to do that, will pitch and sell the book to both audiences, and hope that the straight audience is as receptive as the gay audience, which has been lovely. But I think that it's an interesting sort of dilemma to try to solve.
Yeah. And I think it's just like reviews. It's easy to focus on the negative. A lot of people read the book, they enjoy it, they say, wow, that was a good book, and they put it down. And then you get the individuals like him who have to, you know, put in the reviews or make comments like, why is that character gay? They tend to stick with us when we really should know that they aren't necessarily the majority out there.
No, no. And I'm like, kind of like, I don't, you know, I'm not writing for you, so it's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. My husband is a ceramic artist, and he always talks about this. He was having some open house and these ladies came through and they picked up their art and they're like, you know, I don't really like this. He was like, well, it's probably not for you then. He's like, thank you for the feedback, but it's just not for you, which I would encourage someone to maybe before they buy a book, open it up and read the description. And, you know, I don't think, you know, or hiding anything. If you read a few reviews or something, what the book might contain. I do have one funny story about dodging and burning. This was sort of through my old workplace, but the very lovely person I worked with has a book group. It was more conservative sort of ladies who lunch. And I went out there and they were lovely, but they were very worried about any graphic gay sex being in that first book. Mm-hmm. And I was like, why? I was like, there really isn't. I mean, it's a little, it's not, it's pretty tame. But I think that, I was like, why is this so, I just wanted to ask them. I was like, and I didn't really, because it was my friend. I just, you know, and I was like, why is this so scary for you? I mean, I may partly know that answer, but I don't think I fully understand why it's so scare, like why a gay sex scene, even more graphically depicted, would bother you, you know, especially in this day and age, which I feel like, you know, but, you know, I don't know. I don't have the answer, but it was definitely something that, other than the homophobia, right? But yeah. I don't think there's a really good sort of more detailed answer as to why. I think it's just sort of their own fears they can't fully articulate to themselves. So I would love to get past that as well, but, you know, one step at a time.
And I'm very excited to see authors like P.J. Vernon with a major publishing house.
Oh, yeah.
Robin Geigel with a major publishing house.
Yeah.
Robin, especially, it's just great to see that happening. Do you anticipate seeing that more and more?
I hope so. And both Robin and P.J., I think, are great writers doing interesting things. And I hope we continue to get them out in front of people. I hope that they're, you know, they're blazing the trail for others, right? And I mean, I think particularly PJ, I see, you know, I open up my feed and I'm seeing Bathhouse is coming up a lot. And I think that book is being picked up and read by lots of different people. Mm-hmm. And I think that Robin's book is a superb book. I think I want everyone out there, go read it right away because it's wonderful. And
I
think
agree.
That, yeah, I mean, it's really, it's just so well done. And I'm going to be giving it for Christmas presents. And so I think that be open-minded. It's, I think you'll find, I mean, I'm always like, please lean into our common humanity. We're all of so much more alike than we are different. And if we could just get to that point, I know it's hard these days with all the sort of political stuff going on, but I do think you pick up a book like that and you see the sort of common humanity, not to mention a really gripping legal thriller. I think that what could be better than that? So I hope she continues to sort of get that book out there and get people reading it. I keep, you know, telling people about it. So
we'll hope. I agree with you 100%. I want to go back to something where you were talking about you want people to just not worry about whether the character is queer or not and just enjoy the novel.
Right.
This comes up quite a bit from other authors on this show and just talking personally. Bookstores, of the few that are left, mainly the chain, which is there anybody left other than Barnes & Noble? I'm not sure, but they always had that gay and lesbian section.
Yeah,
and that's gone. It's all mixed in. And if you ask the store, they say, well, this is a great thing because it's become so much more mainstream. Where I talk to some folks that are gay and they're like, no, I want a gay story. I can't browse through them anymore. What's your feeling on that?
I think that certainly I like the idea of not being stuck in the back of the bookstore in the gay and lesbian section. I think that there's sort of a ghettoizing of gay people by doing that. And so I'm glad that went away. Okay. So I get that. I think the problem isn't the bookstore. I think the problem is mainstream publishing, because I think that then what would happen based on that is that then you would see, you know, mixed in the mystery section, for instance, you would go into a store and you would see Michael Nava right beside, you know, some other author with an N name, but, you know, straight author with an N name. He would just be there and you could pick it up and flip through it. But that's not what you saw, actually. I mean, ultimately what's happened is that, I mean, maybe at once, in the, you know, Michael in the 90s, but not now necessarily, or even a few years ago. And so it didn't really, like, essentially they got rid of the section, but then didn't work to create a real integrated, diverse group of books within the mystery section. And that really has probably more to do with publishing than it does the bookstore. Bookstore is just going to put out and, you know, put it wherever it's going. But I think the publishing has to be intentional and thoughtful about creating more diversity. I think they need more diversity, not just in their authors, but in people who actually run the business. They seem to be more and more, at least, you know, talking about wanting to do that. I'm not 100% sure it's happening, but I think there's a conversation that is going on. And so, I mean, you just got to keep pushing, because that's when we'll see more of this change. And so you see something like PJ's book, and which I do think would probably, you walk in Barnes & Noble and I'm guessing fine. I would hope it seems that way. But so I think it will take some time, but I think we have to keep pushing and keep saying, hey, it hasn't been solved just because you got rid of the gay lesbian section in the late 90s or whatever, early 2000s, you know, that it didn't solve anything.
Yeah. When I was at the library, boy, how long has it been since we've been able to go to libraries? A year and a half, 2 years ago now?
Yeah.
I was excited. I was going through the mystery section. I was just browsing to see if a name jumped out at me. And there was Michael Nava's whole Henry Rio series right there.
Great.
And I thought, this is awesome. He's right there in the mix. But at the same time, the negative I see is when I was coming out, I knew there was this little nook that I could go into and not be seen and could find those books I was looking for. I don't know if you're familiar with the podcast Wrote. I had an interview with the guys on there, and one of them pointed out, he said, think back to that little gay and lesbian nook that they used to have. It was always right next to the self-help section.
Oh, yeah. I think you're right.
I said, you're absolutely right.
Or like
right.
Psychology. Sometimes it's like right by this. Yeah.
Yep, exactly. Right, right next to psychology. Yep. Right there.
Yep. That tells you like all the bias in the world just being wedged between those two sections.
So I have a theory and I want to bounce it off of you. I think I've bounced this off other people before. I could be way off base. There's this perception that queer people don't read books anymore like they used to. We've seen the closure of so many bookstores. White Rabbit Books that I used to love to go to is no longer in West Hollywood. And I have a theory that the number that read are the same, But when I used to go to White Rabbit Books, beautiful books on display, but the busiest section was the magazines, the porn section. Mm-hmm. And right. I always wondered if the store was operating because they were able to survive by selling the porn novels and then were able to have just a nice bookstore in the front. What do you think of that theory?
I think it's probably a pretty good theory. I don't know the statistics on how much, but I'm pretty sure the consumption of porn is probably what kept a lot of those bookstores going. You know, it was a part of sort of an important part of their economy and why they were able to have sort of a more mainstream is not the right word, but, you know, mystery sections, gay mystery sections. I think that I'm sure supported it. I mean, it just makes sense. So much of that kind of like finding a nook or whatever, that's all sort of shifted to being online these days. Mm-hmm. So I mean, you certainly can find gay mysteries much faster. I'm going back a little bit. I do love that you saw that section in the library, which I think librarians do a lot of good work. And they're not as subjected to the industry standards as maybe a bookseller has to be.
Right.
And so I think that you'll see more of that going on there. I love the librarians.
Well, we are going to go to awkward questions authors get.
Okay.
So we haven't even touched on all the things I wanted to talk to you about today. So you know the drill here. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yours isn't a mean one, but it's just one of those that's sometimes hard to answer.
Okay.
Where do you get your ideas?
Oh, I know so many authors who just hate this question, and I don't hate it as much. But I get my ideas by reading and watching and listening. And so you just have to be a consumer, both of, you know, other art forms, but also just of being an observer and consumer of the world around you. So I don't know where else you get your ideas except from experience. I'm not even sure why people are so want to know that answer to that question. Maybe that would be more interesting. Like, I throw it back to, why do you want to know that? I want to know why you want to know that.
I think they're just fascinated that you can come up with a story. I don't think they really even think it through. If perhaps they thought back to school when they had to write essays, they would realize the ideas come from all kinds of places.
The question that they mean is like, how do you go about, you know, essentially writing a story? They don't necessarily mean writing a story as in typing it up or writing it down. They mean like thinking of a story. Like, why do you think in a narrative fashion? Because not everyone thinks in a narrative fashion, right? And then my answer would be, heck, I was born with it. that's true. I mean, that's just my thinking just moves that way. So genes, mom and dad, that's where I got it.
Oh, there you go.
That's where I get my ideas.
There you go. Again, this is John Copenhaver, and his latest novel is The Savage Kind, and it's on pre-order right now. When's it come out, John?
It comes out October the 5th.
So get it on pre-order right now before you forget. And look forward to it in October.
Brad, thank you so much for having me on. It was a real pleasure.
Be sure to subscribe to Queer Writers of Crime wherever you hear our show. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.